Welcome to the Making Connections podcast with your host, Spencer Raposo. This podcast was made to interview current registered kinesiologists in Ontario and talk to them about what they do and where they see the future of the profession going. The goal of the podcast is to get a conversation going about kinesiology as a regulated health profession in Ontario. Each episode, we will bring on a new guest with loads of experience as an RKIN that will share their story and any advice for any new RKINs and kinesiology students about current opportunities in the field. In this episode, I interview Lauren Jenkinson, RKIN and CSEP clinical exercise physiologist who works as a cardiac rehab supervisor. Lauren graduated from the University of Guelph and then went to Humber College for the ESLM program. She thrives when helping patients create realistic, long-lasting, and enjoyable health behavior change. She was also the host for the inaugural season of the CSEP podcast, which focused on mentorship in the field of health and fitness. In this episode, we talk about her role as a cardiac rehab supervisor, her experience as the podcast host at CSEP, and the advocacy we need as kins to let people know what we do. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Spencer. How's it going?
I'm doing well. So I want to welcome to the podcast today, Lauren Jenkinson. Today we'll kind of be chatting about her story, about how she came in RKIN and what she does in her current role with UHN. So Lauren, to kind of start, I want you to just kind of start from the beginning and kind of let us know how long you've been in RKIN for.
Yeah, sounds good. So basically I wrote the very first sitting of the RKIN exam, which was in 2013. So I was an RKIN, I guess as early as they were RKINs without being grandfathered in. And so it's been 7 years.
Wow, geez. time does fly. So from there, how did you kind of get to where you are now is what we'll kind of dive into. So I know some people have stories back when they were a kid that kind of influenced their decisions, but you can kind of start as early as you feel is appropriate.
Sounds good. Yeah, so I think the typical story for a lot of kinesiology students comes from being an athlete. And I guess the atypical part of my story is I wasn't a very good athlete.
Yeah.
I liked a lot of different sports, and I definitely also really liked science. And I always found that, you know, movement was an important part of health. And so I think I knew kind of from the end of high school that I wanted to do kinesiology, but I can't remember who, and it's probably for the best. I actually had a family member tell me that, you know, going to school to take kinesiology and try and be a physio is maybe not the best choice. It's just super competitive. So you're going to be fighting like a dog and, you know, just be prepared. And so that definitely, it had an impact. It turned me off. And so I actually applied to University of Guelph for chemistry. And my first couple semesters were in chemistry. And then I switched over to biology. And then eventually I took kind of one elective course that was kinesiology and was like, no, can't deny it. This is what I really like. And then so I finished my kin degree there. So it just kind of felt right. Like it you know, people can influence you, but I knew that was what I wanted to do. So then the next part came, you know, graduation is coming up. What's your next step going to be? And so like most, I did apply to physio. And I was even looking at, you know, what else do kinesiology backgrounds do? I looked at becoming or taking school for audiology, speech language pathology, you know, looking at kind of different further reaching professions that I knew of at the time. And then we had Humber come to Guelph and sort of pitch this exercise science and lifestyle management program, or ESLM, which a number of the people that you've had on the show
Oh,
have gone
it's
through.
almost it's so many people have gone through. I'm like,
I mean, I can't say enough good about it. And I know that at the time there was a program at Niagara College, which was quite similar, that I don't know much about, having not gone there. But you know, now U of T also has a master's of professional kinesiology. So I think, you know, it's becoming a trend. And but basically when Humber came to Guelph, they sort of said, you know, this is what's happening, because the other thing we knew is that kinesiology was going to become regulated, and there was going to be an exam that you needed to pass in order to call yourself a kinesiologist. And when they came to the school and sort of gave an overview of the core competencies, which there are many of, I remember being a little bit concerned, because a lot of those areas were basically just elective courses at Guelph. And you know, I was already in fourth year. There wasn't any time to go back and take courses that you hadn't taken before, unless you want to stay longer. So it's like, man, what's, you know, what are you to do? So basically I was kind of torn between going to Humber or going home. And I grew up in Huntsville, like a kind of Muskoka area. And there was a clinic in Huntsville that was starting to do VO2 tests. And so I had been in touch with the clinic owner, and they had said, you know, you can come here and you can do this for us. But I also remember feeling unprepared for that. I just thought, you know, I have all this theory knowledge from university, but I haven't had hands-on experience. Aside from being, I was a volunteer student athletic therapist at Guelph, and that was hands-on experience, but not necessarily the same type of thing you'd do in a clinic. So so I decided to go the Humber route. I basically I didn't get accepted for physio. I didn't really know how competitive it was. And it's also, you know, it only takes your first semester grades, I think, from the fourth year. And so I pulled up my socks a little too late, so that didn't happen, and it ended up being all for the best at Humber. I just got exposed to so many different areas of kinesiology, from ergonomics to, you know, occupational health and safety, chronic disease management. And that was the part that I really found interesting, chronic disease management and health promotion, because to me it felt like a very holistic approach to health. You get to talk a bit about, you know, movement, but also other lifestyle pieces that can impact someone's kind of trajectory towards getting sick. So that was something that I was kind of drawn to. And so Humber, their program has a 1 month internship at the end, and I applied to be part of the UHN Toronto Rehab cardiac rehab program for my internship. And I also applied to the Toronto Western program, and they're actually sister sites. So we worked together with Toronto Western, but I ended up going to Toronto Rehab, which is up near Sunnybrook, for my placement, and basically just loved it. It was kind of everything that I saw myself wanting to do. But you know, when it came to choosing your placement, at least for me at Humber, there was two ways you could be strategic about it. You could try and do something that it would be potentially a little bit harder to do without some experience, or you could do something that seemed to have a better chance of giving you a job at the end. Yeah,
Yeah, that makes sense.
so I decided to go. I went with column A, because, you know, in what I had heard from others, it might have been a bit trickier to kind of get a job in cardiac rehab right as a new grad. And you know, sure enough, that was kind of what I experienced at the end of my placement. They didn't have any positions available, which is something that I was, you know, prepared for. But then I stayed on as a volunteer, and started working at a physio clinic in Oakville. You know, Mondays in particular, that was my volunteer night. I lived in Etobicoke. I'd drive out to Oakville and do a day of work at the physio clinic, and then I would drive, you know, all the way across, almost across the GTA to, you know, northeastern Toronto for my kind of night shift as a volunteer. And it was all good, because I loved it. It kind of kept my foot in the door. I was still learning from the staff. And you know, again, as sort of some of your colleagues have mentioned, or not your colleagues, but the people you've had on the podcast, it was sort of a mix of luck and you know, and putting in some work that basically someone went on a maternity leave and they were looking for qualified people to cover her maternity leave. And so, a number of people applied. I wasn't considered, but I was still kind of checking in. And then eventually the person who did actually get the coverage for the mat leave, they were not available on Monday nights. So they actually needed someone to fill just a quarter of a full-time position, from 5:30 to 9 p.m. And I guess that wasn't desirable to many. So they came back to me. I was like, absolutely. And that was kind of my foot in the door in terms of actually being, an employee, and then just grabbing up any small contracts that came my way. So, it was a mat leave here, a mat leave there. And then a research role where I was working in kind of a primary prevention project and also being a clinician. And then eventually that turned into a full-time position. And so once I got to full-time, I was able to leave the physio clinic and do less driving back and forth. So yeah, that's kind of how it worked out. And now I am still, full-time at cardiac rehab, doing right now all virtual care because of our environment with the kind of COVID situation. But yeah, it's happy that I am still working in some capacity right now.
No, for sure, especially like people like myself and other people, like slowly clinics and other places of work are starting to open up. So you were definitely kind of one person that I was like, yeah, you're like, yeah, I'm super busy still. I'm like, wow, that's awesome.
I know it's rare. So I'm very, I'm very feeling very fortunate. And it's the stress of kind of adapting to a very quick transition in the way you work is not really much compared to the stress of not being able to work. So I commend everybody who's kind of making a pivot now or within the last couple months. But so things are going well still here for me.
Awesome. So now that we're kind of brought us up to date in terms of kind of where you are now working as a kind of cardiac rehab supervisor, I want you to kind of touch base and kind of talk about what you do specifically in your role. Because like a lot of listeners may be listening and like they have a general idea about what you do, but if you can kind of describe like what your daily activities are, what you do on a daily basis. Would be on a, let's say on
Yeah,
a normal
sure.
day before
Yeah, that's what
pre-COVID,
I was
yes.
thinking. I was thinking, I'll start with what my job used to look like. So basically the cardiac rehab supervisor title is a little bit misleading because I'm a supervisor of patients. So I would say more accurate might be case manager. And so in a typical situation, like in a week, I look after four different patient classes or cohorts, and each of those classes would have 25 patients in it. And then, the kind of model of our cardiac rehab program, which is a bit different from other models, is that when you have a new class with 25 people, you would also have the support of two other exercise specialists. So whether that be someone who is also an RKIN or perhaps or they're a cardiac technologist, but they have an exercise background, they kind of work with you with your class to help, help with any of the things that you need to do. So basically, if I think the easiest way might be to kind of take you through sort of the patient journey and how I interact with them from the start to the end of their program. So when I get a new class, that means that, all 25 of those people individually have had an exercise stress test. Or a cardiopulmonary assessment, which includes VO2 data, includes heart rate, ECG, blood pressure, their RPE, and all that, as well as a whole medical file, which basically summarizes their medical history up to this point. So, if I'm about to start a new group, I would have 25 charts to go through and make sure I'm familiar with everyone's medical history, any musculoskeletal issues. Basically the things that you need to be mindful of when you're creating an exercise prescription. And then I would use their exercise test data to come up with an approximate walking speed for them to test out when they come on site. And we basically use VO2, and then there's a conversion chart that converts that to a pace and how many minutes can they complete a mile. For some reason we still use miles. I think it's because it's based on the
Yeah, that
ACSM.
makes sense, yeah.
And so our track is 8 laps to a mile, and that's kind of how we get people started. So once they have, once I've got that kind of information on them, but I've never actually met them. So day one, when they come in, they do what we call an exercise trial, where, basically they try out or try on the exercise prescription that I've made for them. And it's not uncommon for people to often, they complete their walk in a way that feels comfortable for them. We're obviously trying to avoid any sort of cardiac symptoms, and it's very rarely bang on, as well as you can get scientific with it, seeing a person in real life, oftentimes they're a bit slower than you might have predicted. So then you would take that data and adjust the prescription. And then so that's kind of their initial exercise prescription that they would take and do at home. We're aiming that they're doing at home kind of most days of the week, and then they get to do it in person with us one day of the week. So yeah, so basically, after the very first day that they come on site, my role is primarily progressing their exercise, introducing resistance training, and kind of a lot of coaching. Like, how is this going to fit into your life? What are your barriers? What are your enablers, in a group setting and individually, because you want them to be able to kind of continue with this for the long term, not just for the 6 months they're in the program. And then the other part of their weekly session with us, it's 90 minutes that they come on site each week. So 30 minutes of it would be an education session, which might be done by me. So I would be talking about exercise safety, precautions for hot weather, what symptoms to look for, things like that. But we also have those talks by our dietitians. We have a social worker and a psychologist. We have a medical team. So sometimes they would do the talk, but sometimes it would be me. So that's kind of the typical, like, what I do with the patients is coach them and help them along, progress their exercise in a safe way, and then the rest of the time is basically spent documenting and preparing for the next class, because you might need to prepare your education, or maybe you're kind of gathering blood work so that you can have a conversation about that and how it plays into someone's risk factors. So yeah, the in-person time is actually a little bit less than the time where you actually aren't seeing the person. You're just kind of preparing or wrapping up what they've
Yeah, for
done.
sure. It sounds like compared to, let's say, what we'll talk about next is like what you did, let's say, in the clinic and how that's different. But it sounds like your role is a lot more like you kept saying, like as a coach. Like you're really trying to make sure these people make the right decisions in terms of educating them on different things outside of what you're doing just on a day-to-day basis, so they can, like you said, continue on beyond the 6 months of the program.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the other thing too that I kind of didn't mention is that we have different program streams as well. So you have within a cardiac class, you'd probably have a number of people who've had heart attacks. Some of those people may have had a stent put in to kind of open up their arteries. Others might have had bypass surgery. Some might be there because they have a valve issue. Some might have, an electrical abnormality or an arrhythmia. And then we've got, people who have really severe heart failure. So if they've got really severe heart failure, they'd be in like their own group where everybody in that group is a little bit lower functioning. They do kind of specific exercise tailored to them. And the education is going to be a bit different too, because they need to know about fluid restrictions and their sodium intake. And then we've got a separate group as well for people living with diabetes, because we know that they're at so much higher risk for developing cardiac problems. So when I was doing full-time classes on site, I had one of my classes was a diabetes group, and then three were cardiac. So that kind of also makes it a little bit different in terms of the type of education you'd give. But yeah, definitely everything is tailored towards kind of behavior change, and lifestyle modification in order to reduce their risk for either developing a chronic disease or that disease getting worse.
Awesome. No, that totally makes sense. So kind of touching base now, I want to kind of you talk about your kind of role there and how it's different than, let's say, a typical role of an RKIN that is in a clinic. And you did have those that year or almost 2 years, I guess, in that clinic in
Yeah, it
Oakville.
was.
So just kind of talking about the difference between the two.
For sure. Thankfully, having done both, I can compare and contrast them. I would say that my current role has a lot more autonomy. I'm kind of the one responsible for making the decisions about the patient's care plan, rather than the care plan being developed by someone else and then implemented by me. So I liked having a bit more independence in that way. And then sort of what I was saying that appealed to me about cardiac rehab in the first place is I like having holistic conversations where, if someone's hurt their ankle, you're going to talk about their ankle. You're treating their ankle when they come in for rehab at a clinic, versus, if someone comes in for heart disease, it may be very well that they, haven't been active, but what about their sedentary activity as well? What about their eating habits? What about their management of their stress? How about their sleep? Are they taking their medications? And so even though, we do have specialists, like we've got the dietitians and the social workers and the psychologists who can really hone in on those areas, it's still all behavior change. So you can kind of coach people through a plan that's been designed by someone else. If I know the dietitian communicated that this person is trying to include more fruits and vegetables, that's within Canada's food guide, I can check in on them and ask, how's it going with your eating goals? I'm not going to be telling them, exactly how many grams of fiber they should be having per day, but I can still, see how they're doing in a well-rounded way. So that's something that I really like about my current position. I didn't actually do any documenting when I was a kin in the clinic that I worked at, and I don't know if that's changed a lot. I think it was basically, because the physiotherapist was creating the plan, like it was already covered in their documentation. So that's a bit different. Once you do your own charting, it can be a bit time consuming, but it's of course necessary. So I'd say that those are kind of some of the bigger things. When I was at the clinic, though, I need to give credit to the fact that I had amazing mentors at that clinic. Like there was a pelvic health physiotherapist named Anne Dory, and I worked with her specifically for a while as her kin. And she gave me a lot of liberty in terms of helping her create education materials for her patients. So I was like drawing out anatomical diagrams of the pelvic floor, like what the muscle tissue looks like. So that people could kind of picture what they're trying to activate, and I was helping with sort of ordering products that were useful for her, and there was even a point where it was Lifemark was the clinic that I worked at, and so Lifemark was trying to create cardiac rehab programs and cancer rehab programs to somehow integrate into their care models, and so, when they started saying that they were trying to start this, I got involved with that. So I think that you can sort of make opportunities wherever you are, or just sort of grab whatever comes up. So yeah, it was good to be able to do that at the clinic. It definitely gives you a chance to just kind of learn about interacting with people, and that's behavior change too. If you want someone to do their physio exercises, it's still really important to know about motivational interviewing or counseling or coaching, whatever you want to call it. To kind of get to the bottom of the things that might be getting in their way.
No, for sure. And yeah, I just want to make sure to clarify and look at the differences between the two, because I know even like cardiac rehab was something I definitely was interested in, but didn't know a lot about. So obviously stuff like that deters you away from kind of exploring that avenue of occupation. So for sure.
Yeah, and it was interesting too because there was one of the physios that I worked with who, I really liked her. She was great, but I remember her saying like, "Oh my gosh, you want to go to cardiac rehab? Like it's just going to be the same thing day in and day out, another MI, another stent." And to me, I just thought like, first of all, what's so different about, if someone has had you see people who have low back pain all day. But the reality is you don't get bored of that because people are people and every person is different. And you can get so many different stories of someone who's had a similar journey, but rarely are you going to find someone who's had, that similar of a journey anyway. So it certainly hasn't been boring for me at any point.
And an important point that I wanted to kind of make point of, I guess, was the difference between the two are, like you said, with the kinesiologist role in the clinic and the physio, you're kind of
treating someone more so, and let's say it's an ankle or a back, whereas mm-hmm. in your coaching role, you, like you said, you're taking the more holistic, more bigger picture. And that is something mm-hmm. that is, for some people, like harder to kind of talk about. For some people, it's easier. So knowing the difference between the two is important for any of the listeners here that are kind of like, yeah, like I like just, okay, that's what it is. That's what I do. Whereas mm-hmm. with yours, it's kind of you're kind of creating relationships with people, educating mm-hmm. them, you know, the whole scope sort of idea. And mm-hmm. so the next thing I wanted to kind of talk about before we kind of go into kind of your experience so far as it can was, some listeners may not know this, but Lauren was the mm-hmm. podcast host for the first season of the CSEP podcast under mentorship. One thing I never even asked you on mm-hmm. our previous call was how you managed to get that position and how was your experience with that?
Right. Yeah, sure. So it was kind of another bit of a serendipitous moment because I was doing my College of Kinesiologists self-assessment 1 year. And, you know, I remember there was you need to make at least 3 goals. And so I came up with 2 goals just like that. You know, I definitely knew that these were things I wanted to do. And then my third goal, I was like, I kind of want to do something that advocates for our profession. And so, you know, what might that look like? And so I think I wrote down, like, I'll apply for a committee within CSEP or within, you know, the College of Kinesiologists. I'll try and sit on a board or be on a council or something like that. And then I submitted the self-assessment and I mean, it couldn't have been like more than hours later that I was just kicking myself being like, that's so not me. I'm going to find that really boring. Like and this is an assumption because I've never been on one of these boards, but just for me, I felt like,
it doesn't sound very exciting. Just even how you say, yeah, just sitting on a board, like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe you'll have to get someone who's on one of the boards on one of your future podcasts and they can tell us how it actually is. Yeah, but for me, you know, I just thought like, oh, geez, I'm either going to have to change my self-assessment or, you know, update it the next year and kind of say, oh, I didn't do this, I did that. Or, you know, I'm going to have to just suck it up and do what I said I was going to do. So I was kind of feeling like that was a bit of a bad call on my part. And then days later, there was actually on Instagram, I was following CSEP and they just put up a post that said call for podcast host. And I remember thinking in that moment, like I was actually at that point in time also searching for a good podcast to listen to on my commute to work that was related to our field. Mm-hmm. And I had been searching for things that were evidence-based and I was not finding a ton that was really relevant to what I did in my work. Like there was an NSCA podcast on coaching, but that's really about kind of high performance. And so when I saw this post from CSEP, it was like, oh my gosh, you know, this ticks 2 boxes. Like this is a way I could get involved with the organization that actually sounds fun and engaging and something I'd love to do. And it, you know, it's also creating something where I feel like there's a void, and you know, that void is now also filled by this podcast, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. but that was kind of what drew me to it. Yeah. And that's what drew me to it. So they basically said, I can't really recall, but I think it was, you know, email us if you're interested. And then they sent an application and then they ended up sending sort of a secondary application and said, oh, wow, you know, surprise, we've had a lot more interest than we thought we might have for this. But you're kind of in the next round. Can you send us sort of like a voice clip or, you know, give us your elevator pitch? Yeah. So I did that. And then they got back to me and said, you know, you sound like the kind of right fit for this. And so that was just very exciting. And so there from then on, you know, we were definitely sort of a team in creating the first season where they asked me if I wanted to be involved in kind of creating the question list. And did I have anybody in particular in mind that I wanted to interview? So yeah, it was a really kind of collaborative project. That I didn't know exactly what was going to come out of it, but it was something I really enjoyed doing. And, you know, and it got decent feedback for the first season. There were just a few people who kind of reached out and told me that it was useful. And that's all you need. You know, one person says that was helpful for me and it was like, great. That's what it's all about. Mm-hmm. So Yeah, it was fun.
No, yeah, I think I even when I reached out to you, I actually listened to all the like the mentorship episodes and reached out to a couple of those people. So for me, it was helpful for me. And sometimes it just takes that one person to listen to that, and then next thing you know, you never know what kind of comes out of it. So I definitely thank you for that.
Right. Oh, well, that's great to hear. That's kind of what it was about, is just sort of, if you can remove one barrier just by knowing that this person's receptive to talking with people, then awesome, you know?
For sure.
So yeah, happy you liked it.
So this second part now, I want to kind of talk about your overall experience so far as a kinesiologist. So you've been working as a kinesiologist now for, like you said, 7 years. How would you rate your experience so far as it can? Was it what you kind of expected? Were you hoping for more? Just general.
Yeah, so I would say like my overall experience has definitely been positive. But you can't deny, of course, that, you know, there's some ups and downs, or more so just, you know, it does take work. So I have to acknowledge that, you know, whatever family member it was who told me it was going to be some work, they weren't wrong, but it's not insurmountable.
Yes.
So I find, I find that, the best thing about the job is just, you know, that you're helping people in a really meaningful way. And when you get that feedback from people, or you see that they're able to do something they weren't able to do before, like that's kind of the biggest takeaway. And that's kind of what keeps you coming back to continue doing what you're doing. So that part has been really great. The other side of the coin is sometimes you can be frustrated by, you can't understand what somebody's going through, but if you've got enough people who are kind of not seeming to follow through with the advice you might suggest for them in terms of their health, that can be draining. And there was actually a point in time, I guess around this time 2 years ago, where I was feeling kind of really, I was working with one of my diabetes groups who was just particularly, seeming to be unmotivated or just having a lot of challenges with kind of uptake in their healthy habits. And it led me to actually working at F45, which is completely different. Like, for anyone who's not familiar, it's a, you know, it's a HIIT training studio kind of boutique gym. But what I was interested with them is they had such a, you know, a big sense of kind of community about their gym. And there's no denying that the people who go there are very motivated. You know, they pay a decent amount for their membership, because it's almost like a hybrid between kind of personal training and group fitness. But they show up and they keep each other accountable. And it was sort of something that I needed at that time in order to balance out my experience at kind of my day job, which was, I was finding it a little bit of a drag. Like, it was starting to feel tedious. I felt like a broken record and just needed to do something else. So sometimes I think having, multiple roles can be useful in sort of breaking up monotony. And I know that when I was working at the physio clinic, as is quite common with some of the people who you've chatted with, the pay can be a little bit anticlimactic. You kind of finished your 4-year degree and then maybe you do a postgrad. You come out thinking that that education might be worth a little bit more than it ends up that you can find. So I remember there being days at the physio clinic where I was, folding towels, like folding laundry. And there would be days where I was thinking to myself, like, oh my gosh, like, I can't believe I'm getting paid $14 an hour to fold laundry. Like, this just, you can get down on yourself.
For sure.
And then there were other days where I was just like, oh my gosh, I'm getting paid $14 an hour to fold laundry. Like, this is kind of funny, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. And that's just the reality is you got to start somewhere. Right. And I'm hopeful that in time, the industry will start to, or not the industry, but, insurance providers and clinic owners and just people who, I guess, are working in the industry will start to recognize the value of the kinesiologist as a part of the team. And, hopefully the pay scale will go along with it. But in my current role, I've been quite lucky because in a hospital setting where my exact role, cardiac rehab supervisor, we've got people who are doing that role who are kinesiologists, physios, nurses, athletic therapists, and occupational therapists. So we actually all get paid on the same scale, which means I make money that's similar to what a physiotherapist would in a, you know. So I've been that way in my current job. But I think in general, you know, getting into kinesiology as a career is not something that someone would do if they're intending to get rich. You know, you do it more so for the feeling that you're kind of helping people and making a difference. And it's also just good to know that there will be sort of a hustle element in making sure that, you know, you're looked after as well.
Yeah.
So.
And that's what I think you've listened to a few of them to kind of hear that, that's what a lot of people end up doing. They go into that kind of clinic role. They move on from there to something they're maybe a little bit more passionate about. And they have to kind of, like you say, hustle, have their foot in the door, different opportunities, kind of take whatever opportunities come at them. And it's, I guess all the people that I've kind of interviewed, it's come to fruition where they've kind of got to that position that they're like, hey, I've spent X amount of years kind of looking for something like this, and I'm happy that I'm in this role sort of idea. So for any of the listeners here, just understanding that you're coming out of school and you don't, you have no knowledge, you don't have you have the knowledge and you have the skills. You just need to have the confidence and you need to keep putting yourself out there. So hopefully opportunities pop up and then you can take full advantage of them and be ready for them. So, and especially for like someone like me, who I've only been an Arkin now for like 3 years, almost three years now. And it's kind of, for me, I'm looking at it like, okay, like what's my next step? I've been in the clinic for X amount of time. Where am I going to go? Am I going to try to go up in the company more in a managerial position, or am I going to look out, elsewhere? So it's definitely important for people to understand that they need to kind of look at where they came from and kind of really kind of have an idea of what they want to do, and kind of keeping that foot in the door and aiming that way.
Totally. Yeah. And I think there's part of it that's sort of like knowing the general direction that you want to go in, and also recognizing that every day's experience and interactions are going to shape that along the way. So, you know, having an exact trajectory in mind is a bit intimidating, and you know, sometimes you feel, or at least I have felt pressure to have it all figured out, like what's my next move, but you know, that might not be the sort of natural way that it goes. And so as long as you have a general idea of the things that you are really passionate about or good at and you want to be involved with, you can kind of do as much as you can to get involved with those things or network with those people. And then, you know, it might just be that there is a bit of an element of circumstance that will kind of get you there in the end.
So the next part here, I want you to kind of chat about, and we'll chat about it together, actually, is where you see the future of kinesiology going as a profession. I know you kind of touched base on it there when we were talking about being like a clinical kin and hoping that as insurance companies and clinic owners start to see value, stuff goes up. But where do you personally see the future of kinesiology going as a profession?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously right now we're seeing a shift that was kind of a shift by necessity rather than, you know, a choice in terms of, you know, a lot of people kind of transitioning to virtual care, and the, you know, the messaging from the college at first was, you know, is kinesiology an essential service, and is that something that can continue to happen? And then, you know, it was decided, yes, you know, it can, and you may or may not be sort of working under the regulations of whatever company you're at. But I think that, you know, virtual care is a bit of an interesting beast because it allows for potentially more efficient or more cost-effective method of treatment from, you know, an OHIP dollars perspective. But, you know, there's a bit of a trade-off in terms of potential adherence, potential motivation. And, you know, that's something that is kind of, I'm experiencing it firsthand working with virtual care right now. And I guess I never did sort of say how my role has developed, but basically at this point we're not seeing any patients in person. 100% of my contact with them is just by phone and sending resources by internet. And we no longer have that exercise test because having someone, you know, breathe into a mouthpiece and collect their saliva is not probably a good idea at the moment. So, you know, that's not happening. And so there's had to be a bit of a shift. So I think kinesiologists, if you have that kind of health coaching background, I think you can be very versatile in a number of lifestyle modifications, which may be necessary in helping manage either chronic disease or even better would be prevent it. And so, you know, I'll kind of use that as a segue into one of the other areas I think will be sort of the future for KINS is getting more on the prevention side of things, as opposed to sort of traditional medicine or traditional Western medicine would be much more reactive, right? You don't go to physio until you've actually hurt something. You don't go to your doctor until you're ill. Same thing with the hospital, right? So if, you know, if there does start to be, again, kind of coming back to insurance companies, potentially, if there's more research available to sort of decision makers that shows that, oh, if, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, if you can kind of demonstrate that outcomes will be better and money will be saved by investing in people before they're sick or injured, I think that's kind of an area where we really have some specialty, focusing more on healthcare than on, you know, on sick care or reactionary medicine. So yeah, I think that that's where we can become sort of an integral member of a healthcare team. I think it'd be amazing if you had kinesiologists working at every, you know, diabetes center where people are diagnosed with pre-diabetes. You know, there's potential you could avoid going on medication if you can make some of these lifestyle adjustments. Here's our kinesiologist. They're going to tell you about that. So that's kind of my hope for the profession.
Yeah, no, for sure. And that's something like actually like every person I talk to says, and that's one thing that's like, I want to hope to kind of eventually chat with people about is how do we get to that next step? Because it's clearly in everyone's minds and everyone understands the importance of exercise, and how it can be used as preventative model rather than kind of reactionary in how we see our typical healthcare system. But in terms of how we implement it, like you said, having more research to look at that it's worth it rather than saying, oh, yeah, we know, but like, does it make sense to? So, yeah, I'm really definitely curious about how that in itself will happen.
And I know that something that you've talked about with previous guests as well, and when you were talking about when you were talking with Rebecca Adaman about kind of advocacy for the profession, I think it is still quite young, as especially as a regulated profession. And so my experience has been that people outside of my program aren't necessarily familiar with what a kinesiologist does. And I think every opportunity that you can find to sort of inform people of what it is you do or what other kins might do is a positive opportunity to take. Like I was having a COVID test a few weeks ago because the hospital wants everybody to do sort of an asymptomatic swab and figure out the burden. And when I was getting my test, the nurse was looking at my name badge and she said, you're a kinesiologist. What do you do? Like, where do you work in the hospital? And, you know, so I was telling her, I work right next door in cardiac rehab. And she was someone from downtown. UHN is massive. It's the hospital network of Toronto General, Toronto Western, Princess Margaret, and then the five Toronto rehab sites. So she worked downtown. I don't think she even really knew that we had cardiac rehab, spinal cord rehab, and stroke rehab all up in our little bubble. Yeah. And so, you know, just talking with her, I'm a kinesiologist, this is what I do here. And she was just like, that is so cool, you know? And as I was leaving, I was hearing her tell her colleague, like, she's a kinesiologist and she does this. And it was just like, oh man, who would have thought that, you know, that would be a conversation that I was going to have today, or that she thought it was interesting enough to share with her colleague, you know? So yeah, that was kind of cool.
No, definitely. Like, you talk to anyone or most people, they don't know what a kinesiologist does or is, but like, it's like, oh, like you're a physio. They know exactly. Like, even my girlfriend, she's an occupational therapist. So even like still to this day, I'm still kind of don't know exactly what they totally do. Do you know what I mean? Like, do you know what I mean? Right. Like they, cause they do have a lot of hats depending on where they are, if in a community hospital, different places, but yeah, it's definitely a lot harder for us because as kinesiologists, you can work in so many different places. And so that kind of doesn't really target one kind of audience to kind of be like, okay, this is what kinesiologists do and puts us in that kind of bubble. Whereas like physio, it's like, oh, it's rehab for a musculoskeletal injury, for example. So yeah, it's definitely tough to advocate because there's so much variety and the scope is so broad.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, for any of us who can at least speak to what we do, that's at least starting the conversation, right? So yeah, I always just try and kind of think of it as you're certainly not wasting any time by at least, you know, sharing a little bit, and then perhaps who knows if that might grow. So yeah.
No, I agree. So to kind of wrap up this kind of part, I want you to kind of finish up with any advice you have for any of the kinesiology students who are potentially listening and they're thinking about writing the exam, but they don't know if it's worth it, or advice for any sort of new or prospective RKINs that maybe just wrote the exam. They're like, okay, what do I do next?
I'll probably kind of focus more on that second group because it's been long enough since I wrote the exam that occasionally I'll have a student sort of reach out to me and ask, you know, how to prepare for the exam. And I think the reality as well, since I wrote it, it's probably changed a lot because each year they would get feedback on the questions and, you know, and sort of tailor it more and more. But I think, you know, if you're deciding whether or not to become registered, it is a big decision. You know, it's money, especially if money is tight, you want to kind of weigh out what you're going to get from the designation. And so for me, like what I can say about that whole thing is that at UHN and to have my role as a cardiac rehab supervisor, you do need to be a registered health profession. So that only came into place, you know, when kinesiology became regulated. And I think before that, you know, they were people who were, you know, they had a certification. So they had their CSEP CEP or they had the ACSM CEP. But then as soon as kinesiology became regulated, they needed to get regulated to keep their job. And now if anybody wants to become, like if they're applying to be a cardiac rehab supervisor, that's one of the requirements of the job. So you may find that in certain settings, you know, they're asking for RKIN now, versus other places, maybe it would be fine to have, you know, a CSEP CEP or some sort of personal trainer designation or, you know, there's so many different certifications, but I think depending on the area that you might want to work in, potentially I would just kind of look up or talk to people who do work there and find out whether or not they, you know, they need to be akin to do their job. So that's kind of the biggest advice or the only thing I could say about kind of deciding whether or not someone's going to challenge the exam. I think for someone who is a new kin and is just trying to sort of navigate the field, I do, you know, I have sort of empathy for those people right now because it's such a different time than when I came out of my postgrad. Like I had just done my placement. Right now, a lot of placements are canceled. You know, I said that after my placement, I was volunteering. Right now, we're not having volunteers. So I think there's kind of different ways where you could use this time. Like you could probably use it as sort of self-reflection and, you know, a time for consuming information, whether that be in the form of books, podcasts, whatever, trying to sort of figure out your path a little bit and network. Because if you can't, you know, necessarily shadow someone in person, they may still be very willing to chat with you about what they do and sort of, you know, allow you to pick their brain. It could also be sort of a time when you're doing continued education, which maybe someone who's just come out of their degree is looking for a break from, you know, but I think that you can use time, in an effective way, one way or the other. And, I think creativity and gaining experience will be something that's important. I know we talked about that kind of before we went on air, so to speak. So Yeah, so I think that that's, you know, whether that be kind of looking at your friend group or your family and sort of imagining how you might design a program for one of them. And then I don't know whether you could follow through, right? Like you'd probably actually even need to look at the CKO guidelines again and see whether or not that's an area that's okay to do things. Probably not charging, obviously, but you know, just kind of getting the experience of creating a program or you know, health coaching with somebody. Yeah, I think that that's kind of a way people could potentially be sort of using their time right now, but certainly reaching out to people who they're sort of interested in their role is always a good place to
For
start.
sure. And yeah, that's kind of what you talked about on your podcast episodes with CSEP, kind of reaching out to those people. And you know what I mean? The worst thing they can do is say no or not answer you, and then you just move on, right? And
For
you
sure.
have to take as many at bats as you can to kind of hopefully hit one of them a home run, and you never know what comes out of it, right? So it's definitely, especially
Absolutely.
with this time, like you said, really trying to take advantage and find creative ways to kind of get experience while we can't really be physically with someone, which is all of our jobs, right? Is being with people and helping them take care of themselves. So it's going to be really important for people, like you said, to network, to kind of build those skills, kind of reflect on maybe things they want to do and try it. I've definitely seen the increase of a lot of people on my Instagram or other social platforms saying, hey, like I was in school for a kin, or I'm in school for physio. Like I'm looking to help people. Message me if you need any help with an exercise program or different stretches for your low back that I could help you with. So definitely trying to take advantage of that internship, I guess you can take on yourself.
Yeah, right on. I know, and I think that's so important. And I think that it can sound very cliche to say like network, 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 because you hear that so much. And I think people also have sort of different ideas of what networking means. And you can have, you know, all sorts of connections on LinkedIn, but it can be so much more meaningful to actually create a connection, like reach out to somebody, say what it is that you're interested about, learning from them. You know, it can go a lot deeper than that. And so I think, you know, just kind of breaking free of some self-limitation of, well, what's the worst thing that can happen now if they don't write back to me? It's you know, it's really not that bad.
No, yeah.
I think that
I agree.
yeah,
Like
that's
even
important. And I
yeah,
think,
sorry, go ahead.
no, go
No, I
ahead.
was saying even for
So
me,
Canadian.
like even reaching out to people for this podcast, like some people don't answer me. I'm like, okay, like that's fine. You do your thing. Or even when I was first applying for all my jobs, like when I wrote the exam, I was like, okay, now I have to actually go out and look. I remember looking on the CKO website and looking at all the kinesiologists in London, where I currently am, and saw where they worked and wrote all of them an email or tried to call them. Like I remember it was like
Right, that's
74
awesome.
emails that I sent, cold emails, got two or three back only. Like, and then one of
Right.
them emailed me back saying, hey, like I'm not taking students right now because we're actually hiring. Like, would you like we'll let you know when we hire that person. So then I wrote back being like, hey, could I interview instead? And the guy's like, yeah, I guess so. And guess what? I had the interview the
There you
next
go.
day, got the job. And I was like, it took me 74 cold emails, only two responses, and I got a job out of it, right? So it's really kind of shooting your shot. And the worst thing he could have said is no. And guess what? I would try someone else. And it's really about luck, about timing. I mean, you had all those contracts, those mat leaves, and it kind of one thing led to another, but you're always there. So it's definitely really important for anyone who's starting to kind of create that network. So when something like that happens, people are like, oh, hey, so and so was, we should think about them, sort of stuff like that.
For sure. For sure. Yeah, I think timing is a massive part of it, because sometimes even, you know, if I'm at sort of the peak of maybe work stress and life stress and someone reaches out to me on LinkedIn, if they, you know, if they send a personal message or an email, like first responding to that is going to be a lot higher than just sort of accepting an invite. Like that's easy. That makes a LinkedIn connection, but it doesn't make a real connection. And so if, you know, if someone says like, oh, hey, you know, I'd like to chat with you or something like that, and I know for me, it's just, you know, it's just a little bit more than I can handle at this exact moment, I think the timing can still be, you know, it can still be used in a positive way. Like, well, you know, right now things are a little bit crazy, but, you know, why don't you check back with me in a month? Or, you know, maybe, you know, direct them towards someone else who they might be interested in. Yeah. So, the timing, you know, or as you said, perhaps it's like, well, you know, I might be a little bit busy, but I know that we're going to be accepting interns soon, or this person just finished volunteering and they might have some good, like,
yeah, things like even for this podcast with us, like you had to reschedule from last week because things get busy, right? And it's always just luck with stuff like that. But I wanted to kind of conclude here and kind of really just say thank you so much, Lauren, for taking your time out this evening. I know you're busy all week and we have to do this in the evening. So I thank you for taking your time out of your day today. You were an awesome guest with lots to kind of talk about and share. And we share a lot of similar views and same as a lot of the guests. So I hope a lot of people take a lot of value out of this. So again, thank you so much for taking your time out today.
Oh, awesome. No problem. It was very fun.
Awesome. And lastly, I just want to say thank you to all the listeners. So thanks for taking time out today to listen to this full episode. I look forward to releasing more podcast interviews in the future. So if you know of any other registered kinesiologists that would be an awesome fit for this podcast, you can email me at makingconnections@gmail.com. Also, if you have any comments, questions, concerns, things that you think we should be talking about, all that can be directed at that email or on our LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram pages. Both are, or all of them, are at Making Connections Podcasts. Links for anything that we talk about today will all be in the show notes. And again, thank you for listening and have a great day. Stay safe out there from the Making Connections team. This podcast is sponsored by Kinformation. Are you studying for the COKO RKIN exam and need some guidance? Go to kinformation.teachable.com for a free study guide course on how to start your studying today. Link will be in the show notes below.